Shrink Wrap Radio number 594, Breaking the Silence on Childhood Sexual Abuse, with Dr. Rosina Bakari.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Rosina Bakari, PhD, is a speaker, poet, and author, and we'll be discussing her experiences as an incest survivor as documented in her new memoir, Too Much Love Is Not Enough, and it's about living as an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse and why she decided to break her silence. For more information about Rosina Bakari, PhD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. By the way, not long ago, I heard from a listener who had an old trauma triggered by one of my interviews, and she urged me to give trigger warnings. I'm not always going to know what might trigger someone out there. That being said, though, this interview is about childhood sexual abuse and incest. So if you have past issues like that, this might be one you'd want to skip. On the other hand, my guest has a very positive message about how she's dealt with that history. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Rosina Bakari, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here, David. I really appreciate you extending this opportunity for me to talk more about adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and the book and the things that I'm doing to try and break the silence. This is a very, very important space for me to have, so I appreciate it greatly.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to be able to provide that space for you and to have a chance to kind of meet you and interact with you. And you mentioned your book. You've got a memoir that just came out this month, right? It's titled Too Much Love Is Not Enough. And it came out on the 12th, is that right?
Yes, last week, yes.
Okay, well, congratulations. That's got to be a red letter day.
We had a magnificent book launch here in Colorado Springs. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's great. And the title of the book is Too Much Love Is Not Enough. That's kind of paradoxical sounding. What does that mean? How can you get too much love?
Right. It is a paradox. And it's probably, for me, the most important paradox that I came to understand on my own healing journey. So the idea, what the book is about, me living in 40 years of silence as an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And the focus is really on all the attempts that I made to either at some point hide the silence, that didn't work, tried to speak, that didn't work, tried to hide the silence, that didn't work. So it seemed like nothing that I was doing was going to, was getting me quite where I wanted to go. And that was because everything that I was doing, I was approaching it from a position of loving people. Like, how do I do this and still love the people that I want to receive love from? Mm-hmm. And instead of doing it from a position of healing by any means necessary. So ultimately, the conclusion that I came to was that there was not enough love that I could give to heal what needed to be healed in me. Uh-huh. So the love that I was giving was really too much love. Of course, if it's too much love, it's not really love at all. It's something else that you're giving and calling love. Ultimately, that's the reality. No matter how much I tried to love my way through this process, all I was doing was really hurting myself further. So that too much love that I was giving, I had to come to terms with the fact that it was never going to be enough. It was not enough love. I could not love my way out of this. I had to actively heal.
So would another way of saying that be that you were disempowering yourself?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. In the name of love. And that's too much. No one should have to do that, right?
Yeah, right.
So too much love is not enough.
Okay. Interesting. And the subtitle is a memoir of silence of childhood abuse. Now, just this past week, I mean, this is so timely. Just this past week in the New Yorker magazine, there's an article titled The Silence. And it's by, the author is Jeannot Diaz. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he was raped at 8 years of age. And he describes the lasting impact of that trauma, not just on his childhood, but his adulthood as well.
Right.
So I don't want to take away from your story, but I just wanted to mention that to highlight two things. One is it's not just women. Boys also are the object sexual abuse. And just how timely this is. I mean, this whole awareness of sexual trespassing is just, it's so current and so fresh. So, and so widespread. And so your book is about breaking your own personal silence. And it's a real sort of coming out story. We'll probably be getting into this a lot more in detail, but sort of what drove you to write this book?
So in 2010, I started living openly as an incest survivor, and that's when I created Talking Trees, an empowerment organization for adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And 2007 is when I had this awakening, if you will, that I was not, I couldn't continue living the way that I was living in silence, that if I was not willing to recognize the trauma, no one else was going to. And that goes back to the too much love thing. And so I spent years trying to unravel all the lies I had been telling myself for 40 years and unwrapping what I thought was love. That's a lot to unwrap when you're over 40 years of age and you've lived all of your life trying to be part of this family and trying to do everything that that society and culture tells you you should do as a family member, right?
Yeah.
Especially with and so having to unwrap that, and you have to lay everything on a table, because once you give up family, or once you come to the realization that family is not what you want it to be, everything changes. Like, all of your reality changes. At least that was my experience, and for many of the survivors that I spoke with and continue to speak with. So if family is a lie, then it's kind of like everything else can be a lie too, because so much of who we are comes from our experience with family, right?
And you're talking about the family you grew up in.
Correct. Yes, the birth family. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And keeping in mind that, like me, 80% of childhood sexual abuse is incest. So that was my case. And so it's huge. So as I began to look for resources to help me unwrap all of that, there were very few resources available. So it was a slow process of finding people to talk to, finding people to listen, and a difficult, challenging process. In 2010, I decided to start Talking Trees, because I had accumulated enough information that I felt like it was vital to share with other survivors. Because I realized
why Talking Trees? Talking Trees.
It was a poem. I said in 2007, I made a determination I wasn't going to live like that anymore. I'm trying to gather these resources. So I'm trying to gather outside resources for information, and I'm also trying to grapple with what's happening inside. So I started using poetry to do that. And I had been writing poetry before that, but I had never written anything about the sexual abuse. And so I started using poetry to explore what was happening. It was really difficult for me to write about the sexual abuse. Like, I still couldn't do it. So I would write a lot of metaphors about the abuse, instead of writing about the abuse. And so one of the metaphors that I wrote was about how men go through the forest and ruin all these trees because they don't pay attention to them. And they never know even the damage that they make, because they just do what they do in the forest and leave and never see the damage that they do to the growth of the trees. So I wrote this poem called Talking Trees. So after that, everything that I did just became a part of Talking Trees, Talking trees, talking trees. I wrote eventually the poem turned into a play. The play turned into an organization.
you are a very dynamic woman, and you're spinning off projects so fast. I don't know how you keep up with yourself.
It's hard sometimes.
Yeah. Now you are a poet, and that's one of the things that I wanted to highlight. And I asked you if you'd be willing to recite a poem here. This might be a good place to do it, since you just mentioned your poetry.
Thank you very much. So I'll give you some. So this poem came after Talking Trees, the Talking Trees poem. But again, you'll get a sense of what I mean when I say trying to find these metaphors and ways to address the abuse without actually going into that scary, dark place to address the abuse. So, and what I felt like I was missing at the time. So bear with me.
And you let me know ahead of time. You said, because I had written to you and said, hey, because I knew that you were a poet, and I also found you on YouTube, and you're reciting poetry there and really powerfully. And so you wrote back to me and said, well, I'd love to do a poem, but the one I have in mind is 7 minutes long. And at first, we were both concerned, well, is that too long? Well, at first I thought, maybe that's too long. But I don't think it's too long. People are going to watch this, hopefully, and listen to this show. And if they want to get to know you and your passion and what you're about, so I'm just talking to you, audience, now. You should be willing to invest 7 minutes in this woman's poetry.
Right. And the other important piece is that I think this is going to be the signature poem for the We Too movement. It's the one that I did at the launch, and it's really the one that I feel like I must share with people if they want to understand what survivors experience. So if you want the book, so you can read the book in 279 pages, or you can listen to a 7-minute poem and they deliver the exact same message. So it's
good. Okay. Okay.
So it's called The Gift of My Pain. I have a gift that I cannot give away, for I have tried and tried. The gift that keeps on giving are the tears that I cry, but everywhere I turn, people turn away from my pain. They turn their back with a silent request for me to look like a picture in a frame. I am too beautiful, too special, too smart to carry such anguish. So talking about pain is like speaking a foreign language. Some cultures give you 48 hours to bury the dead, but the pain I carry got buried in my head because there was no proper mourning for the child that died. So I carried her around inside of me like she was still alive. Now, she seemed to be invisible to everyone else, so I created voices in my head to talk to her. I thought they would help me protect her. Instead, they too rejected her. So as I got tired of carrying all of the dead weight around, along with the voices in my head and all of their sounds, I reached out to you and you and you. But you told me to forget about her, too. Songs tell me to smile, even though I hurt, just smile. Friends tell me to be strong because just one of my tears is big enough to drown a relationship. And family thinks that my pain is just a figment of my imagination. I am too beautiful, too special, too smart. So those voices in my head keep fighting and healing never starts. Meanwhile, the ones who murdered my childhood walk around free while I spend 40 years trying to resuscitate me. How do you revive a heart that's gone cold? How do you save the life of a 7-year-old trapped inside of the body of a grown lady with a brilliant mind but who cries like a baby? Now, there were occasional pauses in the pain and new signs of life, like when I became a mother and when I became a wife. For a while, the hurt didn't run so deep. The voices in my head finally went to sleep because the pain became numb from mothering tasks, because even the voices in my head could not keep up with all the questions that my children asked. So finally, I get to live through a childhood, yes, vicariously mine. My inner child got along with my real life children just fine. She was so happy she could finally play and feel safely alive. It's like the little girl inside of me never died. But real life children grow up and move away. While my traumatized child, she didn't age a day. She and her pain sits invisibly still, slowly but surely losing her will to reach out, to go on, to invite others in while hoping someone would see beyond the grown-up grin. But I am too beautiful, too special, too smart. The world needs me to play my part, show the reward for living with perfection. Success doesn't come with heartfelt compassion. So today I offer you a gift, the gift that usually gets dismissed like Monday's junk mail that gets thrown into a pile of recycled paper until trash day when this city becomes responsible for taking it away. Now, before you tell me it's going to be all right, can you hear what I have to tell? Can you honor the fact that the pain inside of me runs as deep as a well? Before you put your arms around me to say, I am too beautiful, too special, too smart, can you listen to my aching heart? And before you wipe the tear from my eye, will you acknowledge that I am hurting? And for one moment in time, will you please just help me carry my burden? Because there is nothing spiritual about being so strong that your strength covers up your perpetrator's wrong. And there is nothing godly about holding back a tear. Courage has nothing to do with hiding fear. And if you think that pain makes you stronger, you need to listen just a little bit longer to what I have to tell you about what I've been through. Please don't dismiss me like the others do. See, I still mourn for the childhood that I never had, and thoughts that I am unlovable still makes me sad. And I have yet to silence those voices that argue amongst themselves so loudly in my head that I feel so insecure and sometimes wish that I were dead. Pain does not build you up. It brings you down. It is only in the sharing of pain where healing can be found. But many dismiss my pain, perhaps to ignore their own. People refuse to cry as a sign of being grown. So I've come to realize that my pain isn't just about me. It was meant to be shared, to set others free. Sharing my pain is a gift to you. Please don't dismiss me like the others do. If you create space for my pain, you can share yours too. That is what healers of the new world will do. Stop chasing eternal salvation and create your own internal salvation. Let's ignore those who confront us, not the cry. We shouldn't have to forget about our pain. We shouldn't even try. I may not even understand your pain, but I'll give you space to explore it. Bring me your tears and tell me you hurt, and I promise I will not ignore it. Because if you could follow the tracks of my tears, you would be glad that I'm finally here. Enfold me in your arms and tell me you care. Promise to listen and say you will hear. Because what I so desperately want to convey to you is a survivor's pain inside. Because you may be the next person in whom a survivor confides. Thank you, David.
Wow. Thank you. That is such a gift. And as you say, it really puts the story out there in such a feelingful way that people have to respond. So what a tribute. And I'm also amazed that you can remember it all. That would be a major thing for me. So let's drill down on the story a little bit. You were abused by an older brother, is that right?
Yes, at age seven, by my 18th brother.
Yeah. And how long did that go on?
Just once. That was just once. And as discussed in a book, I don't have much memory of that. And so that was a first issue in terms of healing, which it is for lots of adults. When I started healing and doing all this research, it was interesting because I felt I was at a crisis in my life again, where I felt so alone and so misunderstood. And when I started doing the research, it was interesting because I was carrying around all this shame and isolation because I felt like I was the only one. And then when I realized, based on the research that I was reading and the understanding that I was getting, I was so stereotypical, right? For once, I felt normal in this realm of abnormality. So I was very normal in terms of the age in which the first incidents of sexual abuse occurred, the fact that I had 3 violators, which I then realized was the average number of violators. But no one knows that when you're living in silence, which is one of the reasons it's so important to break the silence. Because if you're not talking and exploring these issues, you feel so alone and like such an idiot and so full of shame because all you are left with is a narrative of the violator.
Yeah. Now, you said that your brother violated you once, but that there were 3 violators. Who are the other violators, and when did those happen?
In high school, with a cousin that I was living with, and then again at age 18 with my brother-in-law.
Uh-huh.
That's the problem when you don't address one thing. One of the counterintuitive things that again requires us breaking the silence in order to understand all these constructs is that it seems like if something horrible happens to you, then our instinct or says, oh, well, then we learn how to avoid that pothole, right? That doesn't happen with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. When something occurs to you so young, then what happens if when that trauma is not addressed, it's likely to happen again. So it's contrary to what people think. But again, if this is information that adult survivors don't have. All you're left is the narratives that you keep hearing outside of yourself. So adults who have been violated during childhood are 4 times more likely to be violated in adulthood when issues are not addressed. So idea that you learn how to take care of yourself is not what happens at all.
Yeah. Do you think it's because what's learned is a sense of I deserve it. I'm not good enough.
Exactly. Or you just don't know how. You just don't know how to protect yourself. You don't learn. There are things that you have to learn in childhood in order to be the best functioning adult that you can be.
Yeah.
And learning how to find your voice and speak for yourself and create and set boundaries is really important. And so when you don't, then it leaves you vulnerable to many negative things happening.
Yeah.
So
you grew up in Philadelphia,
all the
right?
Horrible things that happen, they happen more often to adult survivors.
Yeah. So because also you're wanting love. You need love more than ever. And so you take those risks of people who seem like they're going to give you some love. You grew up in Philadelphia, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think we shared that on the phone once. I went to university in Philadelphia, so I know that city. And so what kind of impact did this have on you in the early years of growing up, in grade school, in junior high, high school? You know, because you're very accomplished, and as your poem points out, you're very bright. And did you just sail through school easily? What was going on?
I kind of did. So this is the fun part, in a very sarcastic way, fun part about healing as an adult, that you have to go back and look at this stuff. And so the things that I can tell you now, only because this is part of the healing process of unraveling that. And so I'm telling you this in hindsight of what I think the experience was. So I was a very awkward child. I don't know if that was before or after because I don't have complete memory of the abuse. But I can tell you for sure after the abuse, I was a very, awkward child that never quite fit in. So I always remember doing things trying to fit in. Like I specifically remember feeling like I don't fit in, but I will do whatever I can to fit in. So sometimes I got in trouble. I got in trouble for stealing. I got in trouble for cheating. But it was never big trouble. It was trouble that said, boy, that's a stupid little girl, right? Like it was just menacing enough not to be serious, but menacing enough that when you read about it, someone says, how come someone didn't notice that these things were kind of adding up to something's wrong or something has gone wrong? I was also always a very bright young lady. I was always, and so people always recognized that I had this sense of brilliance in me. I didn't, and I never felt brilliant, never. People would always tell me that. I never felt that way. So,
were you a big reader? Were you a big reader?
No, I wasn't a big reader, keeping in mind that I was the youngest of seven children. And for the first 8 years of my life, my mother was a single parent. My father was not in my life for the first 8 years. So poverty was also part of my life. So people who live in poverty tend not to have a lot of books. So I don't know if I would. Yeah. So I don't know that I would have been a good avid reader or not. I wasn't. I always asked a lot of questions, and I always loved learning. I did always love learning, but I wasn't always a great student either because I never fit in anywhere. I never really fit in the classroom. I never really fit in with friends. I always had friends, but I was always struggling to be a part of something.
Yeah. So you ended up getting into Cornell. How did that happen? Yeah, that's partly where my question of were you a big reader? I would think that you'd have to be a big reader to get into Cornell.
Well, I never felt smart. I just did what was necessary. So I was, these are things, characteristics that people saw in me. So I was involved in a lot of activities. I had good grades, but that wasn't difficult to do. And Cornell was looking for students who were involved in a lot of activities. So I was, and I had good grades, and I was in a predominantly African American school. So I didn't have a lot of competition. So part of how you get selected into these schools is based on who you're competing with, right? So based on my school district and where I am, probably not as much competition. So I have good grades. I have pretty good grades. I'm involved in a lot of activities. I applied to this school. It's the late 1970s. I went in 1980. And so there are some issues still. We're at the very trail slither of affirmative action going on. So things came together that put me there. Now, some people would say fate is fate. That's what my mama said. Fate is fate. Interesting, when I was in second grade, I got offered a scholarship to private school, and my mother turned it down, right? So my mother says Cornell University was just the universe coming back around to put me where I belong. So perhaps fate played a part in some of that. But even at Cornell, I never felt like I fit in. Like, academics were never important to me. I just happened to be good enough at them. I was never great at them. I didn't really enjoy academics until I got to my PhD program. It was fun. Then I actually enjoyed that. So University of Northern Colorado.
Okay. So, yeah.
So I think that was partly because of age.
Because of age, were you a lot older than when you went to?
Yes.
And at that point,
I was 22 years old when I got my master's degree.
You got a master's too. Okay, you were doing the academic thing, and this is probably a good. You know, in some places you describe yourself as a rogue scholar. And that's ROGUE, not Rhodes as in England.
Right.
But it's cute. And so you are a rogue scholar. In what way are you a rogue scholar?
So I I've taught at the university level, the community college level, and still, in fact, I still teach a couple of online community college classes. As I begin addressing the issues of childhood sexual abuse for me, and then as an organization, and then this universal issue, I kept running into issues of gender. And even when I look at just the childhood sexual abuse, and I look at male victims and female victims, even when the victims are male, the violators are still female. I mean, sorry, the violators are still male, right? So male-on-male violence, male-on-female violence, female genital mutilation. So the more I looked at this, it's like how, at some point we have to address this issue of male violence in the world and how it imposes itself on all bodily autonomy for people, whether through war or sexual violation. And so I started doing some poetry to address that. And that's a really big issue to address in every culture and society. And so my poetry just got bolder and bolder in terms of addressing issues that were beyond my personal experience, to ask the and challenge society to take a look at these issues that make us uncomfortable, that we don't want to deal with. So I started using my scholarship in poetry, where I thought I would reach more people that needed to be reached, instead of in research journals. Mm-hmm. So I turned away from what PhDs typically do with their training and scholarship. Right. And I started using it to communicate with people at the grassroots level. So that's why started referring to myself as a rogue scholar.
Yeah, I kind of identify with that myself. I feel like, I mean, I've got enough stuff on paper to pass, but I've always felt a little bit like a rogue scholar myself.
Right.
Yeah.
I think many of us do.
And I also can identify with the shock of going to an Ivy League school with the history that you had, because I got a scholarship to go to an Ivy League school, University of Pennsylvania. Pretty much for the same reason. Even though I'm white, I came out of a black neighborhood and I had a black stepfather and half sister. And so against that backdrop of the neighborhood that I was coming out of, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked like an all-star. But when I got to Penn, and my classmates who were coming from Harvard and, you know, all those other Ivy Leagues, this was at the undergraduate level, but a lot of people were coming out of prep schools, I'm sure you know, and a whole very different culture there, very different culture. So that must have been such a shock for you. How did you?
Yeah, what school did you go to? What high school did you graduate from?
I graduated from it was actually a Christian day school. My grandmother was an evangelist, and so it was called Culture Academy. It's not there anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So how did you cope at Cornell? What got you through?
I lived in again, this is in the 80s. I was there from 80 to 84, and there was a lot a backlash similar to what it is now about affirmative action and overt racism there. People who really didn't think that people who look like me should be there. Well, that's really difficult when you already don't feel like you should be there.
Yeah, really, really.
What happened for me was that I lived in a hall called Ujima, and it was for students who had a particular interest in uplifting the African American community. So we were 144. There weren't much, all that many more African American students on campus, period. But it housed 144 students, and it was the first time I had ever been around black brilliance to that degree.
Hmm.
And that was incredible for me, because even though I felt like I didn't belong there, I saw people who looked like me that for sure belong there. Wow. And these were people who reflected for me what my potential was on a daily basis. I lived with them. I ate with them. I played with them. I studied with them. They were brilliant. I mean, brilliant. Like not like I've never been in a group of people who looked like me who had all this academic interest and wanted to be doctors and lawyers and architects, and they were just doing it.
Wow, that must have opened up your horizons. Yeah, that must have opened your
horizons. I wouldn't do anything to be part of a group, even study, right?
Yeah, that sure underscores the value of that kind of program and the value of black colleges, you know, and how, you know, how they support talent and intellectual development.
I definitely wanted what they had.
Wonderful. Now, do I recall correctly that in some ways this journey of healing started for you through in one of the classes that you took at Cornell, that you were triggered? Is that right? Or am I making that up?
Triggered in class. I was challenged. I was challenged to be a student in class. That's not true. There's two things that happened at Cornell. One was academic in terms of Dr. Carolyn Whitlow teaching me how to write, but you're speaking specifically about the psychology class. So we're on the same page. Yes. So that was the first real acknowledgement for me, was being in a psychology class, having had these images and fear of my brother growing up. I was feared my brother, but I could not articulate to you why or what had happened. And so as many survivors will tell you, it feels like a nightmare that you carry around inside of you when you don't have the memories. So how do you articulate something that you don't have the memory for, and you're a child. It's almost impossible to articulate it. So you place it somewhere that doesn't interfere with your daily living, is what human beings do to survive. And sitting in psychology class, going and listening to a human sexuality lecture where they're talking about reproduction and bodily fluids and that sort of stuff, and there in the middle of this lecture, it occurred to me what had happened, that rape had occurred. And I just cannot even begin to tell you the devastation when you put those pieces together. It was just a horrible experience. And now here you are, like, what do you do with it? And for me, I never knew what to do with it. So the solution for me was always to find a deeper place to stuff it. That was all.
So you didn't go to the counseling center. Did you ever?
No one talked about those things in the '80s. No one talked about that. No one talked about it.
Huh. I don't remember the '80s well enough to know. So anywhere in this process, did you ever seek out psychotherapy?
That was in 1989, after I had my master's degree and had been working in a field, I got a job counseling as a therapist on a college campus. And I loved that job at the State University of New York at Oswego. Wonderful job, wonderful people, a really healthy work environment, thankfully, because it could have turned out very differently. And rocking and rolling, like just going through life. This was my first real job, making real money, independent. Everything's going great. Somehow I end up with three clients who had been sexually abused. This is still the 80s. No one's still talking about it. And I was doing very well with those clients. And again, something happened. Somehow it broke through my deep denial, and I started really going into trauma mode again, having severe flashbacks, PTSD flashbacks, in a way I never had. Like even at Cornell, when this realization came to me, it was a fear of knowing, but I didn't have flashbacks. I didn't have those PTSD flashbacks. I had the guilt and the shame and all of some other stuff, but not the flashbacks. This time, I started having like PTSD flashbacks, scared the heck out of me. Like I could see things and smell things and paranoid, and it was just a hard, and I couldn't hide it. My normal defenses were all used up. I couldn't hide it. And especially when I'm seeing three clients a week who are dealing with this issue. And I knew that one client was an older person. And when I disclosed to her in our session that I too have been sexually abused, I knew the wall had come down, because that was not something that I was willing to do, much less willing to do in a therapy session. Yeah. So I did it in the name of empathy, but really I knew for me what it meant was that my walls were coming down.
Yeah.
And,
did you seek out any therapy as a result of that? For yourself?
I had to tell my coworkers, because I was not holding up very well. And finally, they insisted, my supervisor insisted that I seek therapy. And so they took those three clients away from me, and I started therapy for a little bit. So,
and was that helpful at all or not?
It was helpful. Clearly it was helpful. I have a lot of issues with therapy. I think we do a lot of things wrong. So I'm not a big fan of therapy, of automatically saying go to therapy, because I think there's a lot of things that need to change. So yes, it was. And again, people still aren't talking about it in the 80s, and we haven't yet come to trauma training and that sort of stuff. The therapist was great. She did all the things that I would do as a therapist. The one thing that she didn't address for me, because I'm so clever at denial, like I am, like denial and me are really friends. Like I really believe deeply that denial is my friend. Like I really deeply believe this, that the deeper I can bury this, like this denial is my survival technique.
Okay.
So I disclosed what I had to disclose because it was just bubbling up. I couldn't. But what I could never come to terms with was my own feelings of guilt and shame. And I didn't know how to articulate that to anyone. So what happened was she did all the right things. One of the things that I talk about in the book was a very popular technique of using a bat to get out aggression and crying. Yeah. A ton of crying. So I'm hitting the bat. It represents the violators and all this stuff. It's great. And even as I'm hitting the bag with the bat, I am realizing that what I really need to address is my own shame, that the person I really hate is myself. Mm-hmm. So while she's asking me to target this as the violator, all the shame, guilt, and hate that I have is directed inward. So this hitting the bat, it does something, but it does not even begin to touch the guilt and shame and self-hate that I was carrying.
Right. What did eventually get you to touch that? Was that the poetry or something else?
It was realizing that no one else was going to address it, that it was going to get deeper. Like I saw it getting deeper based on how I was interacting with family members who knew. Like, but you know, at some point, so in 1989, when I was working with a therapist, she and I agreed that I should have some confrontation with some of the family members. So I did that. It didn't turn out terrible, but it didn't turn out well. My sister, whose husband was a violator, understood and believed me. So I was believed. That's really important for any survivor. I was believed, but I was not supported.
Mm-hmm.
So it was better, but it wasn't addressed. If that makes sense.
What would have been support? If she had supported you, she would have done what?
The one part that I has never been able to articulate to people, because I assume people should know, or I assume there should be some response other than, okay, like, okay, you've been sexually abused. Okay. What I always wanted was to never look a violator of mine in the face again. That seems so basic to me that if I say to somebody, this person hurt me, that the very first thing someone should do is not put me in a room with that person. Like, that just seemed.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
That, like, that was all I wanted.
Yeah.
But it was very clear to me that if I were to be part of this family, that I would forever have to subject myself to being in a room with people who violated me. And I cannot express to anyone how deeply that hurts a survivor.
Yeah.
I cannot. Every time you are in the room with someone who violated you, and people there know the amount of freedom that that gives to that violator.
Yeah. So it wasn't just
incredible.
You. It wasn't just you in denial, but there was this collective denial, right?
Right. Right.
Uh-huh.
So we just all participated for the next 20 years in this collective denial, and I just couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't take it anymore.
Now, somehow, from all of that, you're now married, right? You have a husband. You have a child. And
grown-up children. People say that I have children. I have adults.
You have adults.
I have adults. 25-year-old and a 26-year-old.
Okay. We're going to have to do a big jump forward here. How do we get from all that we've been talking about to this place where you're able to have a relationship with a man, sexual relationship with a man, obviously, and there must have been trust issues. There must have been a lot to work through.
Not when you live in denial. You don't get to work through those things.
You were still in denial going into this marriage at all?
Yes. So it's,
you brought your good friend denial with you.
I bring my good friend denial everywhere with me because people are so happy to participate. One of the things that I realized is that this world is so dysfunctional that it's not hard to look normal. Society is so dysfunctional that you can easily look, that you can easily fool everybody and look normal. Right.
Wow. Yeah.
So I have a lot of resources that help me to do that. And I thought that would be enough.
Mm-hmm.
When people ask me, did you ever see yourself writing a book, or did you ever see yourself being an advocate? I said, absolutely not. I was pretty sure that I would carry these secrets to my grave. I was pretty committed to that.
Yeah,
but
at one place you described yourself as a trophy wife. Tell us about that. How are you a trophy wife?
Right. So this idea, it was another tool for me to use for denial, right? If I have this husband and I have these degrees and these jobs and these beautiful children, then of course there's nothing wrong with me. I was willing to engage in that. My husband was willing to engage in that. So when I said, hey, honey, let's keep this a secret, he said, okay. I'm like, who says okay to that?
Well, he did. He did.
Right. So people benefit. So people all around me, I saw all around me the benefit of silence. And everybody bought into that. Everyone brought it. And
it meant that silence is such a big theme in the book. It's, you know, right there in the subtitle, silence.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's. So the book is all about me, really my buy-in into the silence. I had a 40-year buy-in into the silence. Beyond what happened, that's the trauma begins with what happened, but the trauma is carried on by the silence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know what? I know you've got some other things you want to talk about before we run out of time here, which could happen. I could talk to you for a long time. And So you've got a couple of organizational efforts, things that you're doing. Tell us about those things. You've got something called Talking Trees and the We Too Mission.
Yes.
Take us through those.
Yes, thanks, David. So Talking Trees is the organization that I created in 2010, and we've been working hard to break the silence. We're an organization that encourages adult survivors to live openly in order to heal, because secrets just don't heal. They're not good for anyone, and they don't heal. We don't require people to live in silence. We support people. We don't require people to live openly. We support people in living openly and try to give them tools and resources and a community to live openly. So that's Talking Trees. What's happening now with the book launch? The book launch has come with a Talking Trees mission launch of the We Too mission. Because the book is about my commitment to silence and the destruction that silence can cause, and manifest itself in suicide ideation, depression, lots of physical problems that people don't see, from my asthma to my arthritis to my pinhole in the heart, all this stuff that people don't see. Silence is a destructive force in people's lives. So the We Too mission is calling for people to commit to being listeners for adult survivors. So that's why it's the We Too, the number two, because we need every survivor, one survivor needs at least one listener. One plus one equals the number two. So that's why it's the We Too mission. With the understanding that we can't keep expecting survivors to speak up. We can't keep challenging survivors to find their voice if there's no listeners on the other end. So it doesn't matter who's listening unless people are speaking. What really matters is who's speaking unless people are listening. So what matters is that we have listeners. We've had millions of people over the last 6 months, millions speak up. But where are the millions of listeners? We need people to openly identify themselves as listeners in whatever way that they can. So we need people asking questions at their jobs and employers, like, do we have any protocol for if people disclose, depending on what kind of agency it is? So, for example, at the medical office and accounting offices, where people ask you to check a box if you've been sexually violated or had non-consensual sex, yet don't do anything when you check that box. That's not okay. That's not being a listener. Every place that asks that question should have a protocol that everyone knows what's supposed to happen if a client discloses. Every place should have that. With what's going on now, the conversation is open. It's on the table. We have to begin to train ourselves to have these discussions that create safe spaces for people when they disclose. Doesn't mean you become their therapist or their best friend or their long-term listeners, but we all should have some practice in responding to disclosures. So that's what the We Too mission is trying to forge information about how to respond to adult survivors as they are looking for spaces to disclose, safe spaces to disclose.
Okay. Well, I wonder if there's any last points that you'd like to make before we wrap things up here.
That disclosures are not going to stop happening anytime soon. So again, from a personal level and from a business level, wherever you have influence, don't be afraid to raise these issues before the disclosures happen so that people don't have to always operate out of crisis mode. People need listeners, and there's plenty of information out there now on how people can become better listeners, and TalkingTreesSurvivors.com will certainly be constantly posting additional information about how people can support survivors of childhood trauma, as well as other survivors in general. Again, because denial is not a safe space and silence is not a quiet space. So we need the support of people. And also asking people to, if you don't mind, buy the book, Too Much Love Is Not Enough. The ask that we have for the book because it's the We Too mission, if you want to support the mission by buying the book, we ask people to buy two books, one for you and one to give away, so that we know a dialogue is happening. The book is not about just about the life of Rosina Bakari. If all you learn is information about me, that's okay. But the point of it is for people to become better listeners in the world and recognize that that book represents millions. So what do we do? How do we position ourselves to be better listeners and better understanding of the millions of people that that book represents? So buy two books, share one, and create a discussion. So that's my ask.
Okay. Well, that's a great close. Thanks so much for sharing your passion with us, Rosina, and your story. Rosina Bakari, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been wonderful. I appreciate you, David.
I appreciate you. Even though childhood sexual abuse is such a serious subject, I felt uplifted by the interaction with Rosina. She has such a powerful and positive presence. I'm glad we went ahead with her reciting one of her poems. I found it very powerful. As I mentioned, she also has other interviews and presentations on YouTube. Actually, I just checked again on YouTube looking for one of her other poems that particularly impressed me. It was about her as a poet. She has so many YouTube presentations up there since I last looked, though, that I didn't quickly find it, but you probably will if you're so motivated. In its stead, let me read to you the first paragraph from the first chapter of her book, and I quote, "Silence is not a quiet space, and letting go of the past is not a task. Healing is a work of art. I could no more let go of my past than I could make a picture appear on a canvas by using my mind. But I tried. Despite my effort to live in denial, take on distractions, or ignore the effects of sexual abuse, pain kept begging for my attention like a spoiled child. I cringed every time psychological triggers forced me back to the reality that pain has no place to hide forever. It would live within me until I excavated it from the inside out. I had to find my tools and chisel away at the pain." So you can see how both the poem she recited and this paragraph telegraph her overall story so effectively. What comes across is that the pain of childhood sexual abuse is so intense and shame-filled that it can last a lifetime. Fortunately, we have Dr. Rosina Bakari speaking out, telling her own story, serving as an example of a powerful survivor and champion, insisting that we all speak up for safe space and become active listeners. You heard me give a trigger warning just before the interview as a result of a listener's request. I gave the warning to honor that request, but I have mixed feelings about it. This has been a hot issue on university campuses where students suffering various traumas have complained about being triggered by course content. In the interview with Dr. Bakari, you heard that the university course she took on human sexuality did trigger the beginning of a self-questioning that led to her realization that she had been violated as a child. In fact, many psychotherapists argue that it is the avoidance of traumatic material that can lead to long-standing symptoms of PTSD. They argue that those who've been traumatized can benefit from the challenge of hearing traumatic material discussed rather than fleeing into silence. What are your thoughts on this contentious issue? The title of Rosina's book again is Too Much Love Is Not Enough, A Memoir of Silence of Childhood Sexual Abuse.
Hi, this is Beth Hosfeld. I'm a licensed MFT from Mill Valley, California, and I've recently become a monthly supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio. Last year, I discovered while scrolling podcasts that Shrink Wrap Radio was fabulous, and I began listening as often as I could. Dr. Dave's excellent interviews and interesting guests have enriched and deepened my knowledge of current trends in psychotherapy. I really enjoy listening to guest stories, ideas, and practices. It's a little more personal way to connect with them beyond books and trainings. I've especially appreciated programs addressing trauma interventions. When I noticed that Shrink Wrap Radio has become a regular source of information and connection to the field for me, it seemed only natural to offer my support and gratitude. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Beth Hossfeld in nearby Mill Valley, California. I really appreciate your testimony as a licensed marriage and family therapist, as well as your ongoing donations and your encouragement of others to follow your fine example. You know, in fact, Beth Hossfeld has been a long-term supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, and I want to thank all those others of you who have stood by this podcast over the years. I couldn't do it without you. As you may know, I have a Shrink Wrap Radio channel on YouTube, where for the past several years, I've been putting up both a video of the full interview and also a video clip from that interview to give viewers a taste of what's to follow. Well, I had also been putting that preview clip into the main feed on our website and our Shrink Wrap Radio app. Just recently, I discovered that for some months now, I've been forgetting to do that. Interestingly, I heard no outcry about the missing preview. So unless I hear that outcry from a number of you, I'm not going to worry about it. People can always go to the YouTube channel if they want the video preview. And it also shows up on our Facebook page and our Google Plus page, so you may be encountering it there. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Rosina Beccari, for sharing her story of triumphing over her own childhood sexual trauma and the way she's transmuted the pain of that into activism. Next week, my guest will be licensed clinical social worker Lynn Godsky, who has written the 2018 book, Therapy with a Coaching Edge, Partnership, Action, and Possibility in Every Session. I found that to be a very intriguing topic, and that's why I reached out to her. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.